Okay. Thank you very much for inviting me, Christoph, for this. I hadn't seen the book before I came, so it was a very good opportunity for me to read the book. Thank you very much. It was informative. So I'm very happy that a lot of the discussion was about Aristotelian metaphysics, so I can escape from actually commenting on Aristotelian metaphysics. A lot of the points that were raised, I think, also expressed my points. What I will discuss basically is what I saw as the positive contributions that the book makes to the debates. Then I will focus on some problems that I saw with the book. And then perhaps, depending on the time, we can go more into detail about things. And I have some texts to read and translate and things like that. But if we have time. I promise I will not use Greek. That was a promise given to many people, so I will not. Okay. The positive contributions of the book. Reading the book actually made me realize how many people in the West think like the Greeks. That was a revelation to me. Now, one of the good things that I saw in the book is that it contextualizes the issue of Athens versus Jerusalem. It's very, very important. Now, in the West, there is a conflict, and David did a very good job showing that there is a conflict. But he also stressed that this conflict doesn't exist in the East. And I really like that. So, in the West, there is a traditional perspective when someone talks about philosophy theology that there is a conflict between faith and reason. But in the East, there isn't so much evident. This conflict is not brought into the foreground. He also believes that. In the preface, he makes this evident. And I like that. The book also chooses to focus the discussion on the issue of divine energies. And I really like that as well, because it is one of the key issues to understand the difference between the Western and the Eastern perspectives. Now, another thing I liked about the book is that it examines the issue of the divine energies within the broader philosophical debates in ancient Hellenic metaphysics. That was another very good contribution of the book. If you focus on only the Christian history of the debates, you lose a lot. And David makes a very strong case for that by examining how some of the Aristotelian terms and modes of thought are transformed through Neoplatonism. However, I have to say here that it chooses to bring together the ousia debates, the essence debates, with the energia debates, via the concept of energin katharon found in the anonymous commentary of Parmenides. Now, personally, I will be hesitant about that. I will jump into bringing together these two debates, because these two debates have their own agendas. Each debate has its own agenda. I mean, there are specific things that terms, concepts that are used within the agenda of the polemic of the Hellenic schools of philosophy. Bringing them together somehow blurs the distinctions and the different uses of these terms in these schools. However, I see it as positive contribution. I see it as very positive contribution, because many of the commentators of Byzantine philosophy simply don't go into that. Many of the commentators of the medieval philosophy simply don't go into that. That's wrong. That's a big mistake. Another thing I liked about the book is the strategy of the book. By building up the discussion of the divine energies, it closes with a comparison between Thomas Aquinas and St. Gregory Palamas. And I think that's a very good strategy, because you have there two key thinkers and key theologians of great value. I didn't like that you didn't accept Gregory Palamas as a systematic thinker. I think this is a misconception. But in any case, I think both Thomas Aquinas and Gregory Palamas are the apex of what Byzantine philosophy and what medieval philosophy could reach at that point, 13th, 14th century. Of course, some people may disagree with me, Franciscans, for example. I accept that. I mean, people, you know, these are personal evaluations of things, but it is important to consider two key thinkers, two key important theologians who discuss energies and essence to show what is the difference, contextualize this difference, and discuss about the issues that we discuss. However, again, here I have some hesitancy, even though I do appreciate this positive contribution. Now, the comparison is made between Thomas Aquinas and Gregory Palamas on terms of Aristotelian metaphysics as Aquinas understood it, as the Western medieval philosophers understood Aristotelian metaphysics. I have a hesitancy about that. As it is well known, the medievals, especially Thomas Aquinas, did not know the Aristotelian corpus in its entirety. Did not know that. In the East, they had the Aristotelian corpus in its entirety, as they had the Platonic corpus in its entirety. They didn't need Syrian translations of Aristotelian corpus. They didn't need translations from the Arabic into Latin. They had access to all the corpus, all the books, including the Poetics. They could make conclusions about where the Aristotelian thinking in the metaphysics goes when considering the whole corpus, including the Poetics, because you see there, for instance, discussion of categories in the Poetics. The West never went into that. The Poetics came much later. They already had made interpretations and commentaries on the categories and the metaphysics. They didn't want to even to see the Poetics, and they lost a lot because of that. The East had that at the time of Gregory Palamas. Gregory Palamas actually was an expert on Aristotelian metaphysics, and the biographers of Gregory Palamas actually say that he corrected Theodoros Metochites, a famous Aristotelian in Byzantine court, imperial court, in front of the emperor on an issue of Aristotelian metaphysics. So, okay. Now, another very positive contribution that I saw in the book. Augustine is brought into the picture to explain the differences between Aquinas and St. Gregory Palamas. That's very good. I really like that. However, again, here I have some hesitancy, because Augustine in the East is considered almost a heretic. This is why in the Orthodox Church he's not considered a saint. This is one of the reasons he's not considered a saint, Agios, but divine, Ieros. And most certainly, the Palamites fought Augustine as the root of all Western heresy. And many of the Augustinian theses are condemned by the Ninth Ecumenical Council and the three volumes that were produced in 1351. Now, at the end of 1351, we have these volumes. And I just want to say here an autobiographical thing. In the Orthodox Church, Greek Orthodox Church that I was raised in, we have the tendency, the Sunday after the Sunday of Orthodoxy, the priest, especially the theologians who are priests and they know what they're doing, goes up in front of the altar and reads the volume of 1351, which condemns Varlaam Akindinos and Grigoras as heretics. And the priest says a very serious thing for the Orthodox. He says anathema to all those who support theses that Varlaam, Grigoras, and Akindinos put forward, which is a very serious thing. I mean, you know, remembering this, that's been engraved in my mind from a very young childhood, coming out, the priest coming out and read this in a very solemn way, anathema to all the people who believe these kind of things, I thought personally, you know, after I went into all these debates, that this is something I should avoid as hell. going into all these heresies. Okay. Now, let me elaborate a little bit on the problems that I saw. Okay. Now, David Bradshaw, makes these two very important moves, and I want to concentrate on these two very important moves in the divine energy debates. Okay. Because that's the quintessence of the book, the contribution that David Bradshaw makes into the theology and philosophy of divine energy. I mean, that's his thing. Right? Now, in considering, first of all, he considers the uncreated light as relative. That's a term that he makes. And I quote at page 273, it exists, the uncreated light, as a kind of mutual revelation and glorification within the Godhead, prior to the creative act. So this is one move he makes, and he thinks this is an important move to make to allow the Gregory Palamas theology and philosophy and divine energies to escape criticisms from people. Okay. Again, he is very correct to mention these criticisms by recent theologians that made against Gregory Palamas. He's very correct in mentioning these. Personally, when I read his account of these theologians and the problems they found in Palamas, I laughed. Because these theologians should go and read the volumes published at 1351, where the accusations that they make against Gregory Palamas are mentioned there as heresies. I mean, they are the specific heresies that Gregory Palamas and the Palamites accused of actually Akinvinos and Gregoras making. So it's like these people never actually reading the whole Gregory Palamas corpus or even the volumes. They just focused on specific accusations made against Palamas by various people. And I thank him also to bring this forward. I mean, I didn't know about these accusations against Palamas until I read his book. But again, I mean, these are, for a Greek theologian looking at these commentaries, he can't but laugh. I mean, these are things to laugh about. So this is a very important move he makes. He thinks that by making this move, making the uncreated light relative, he helps Gregory Palamas escape these very poor criticisms against him. Okay, so this is one move he makes. The second move he makes about the unity of energy, divine energies, is that the unity of energies as a class consists in there being acts of self-manifestation of God. Again, in the same page, page 273. So there is a unity of energy as a class. Different energies are unified by being this class of things that are these acts of self-manifestation of God. Again, this is a very important move. Not many people actually make this move. Not many people actually make the first move that he made. And this is very important contribution, his contribution to the scholarship, to bring these things into the debates. Now, my problems with this. Okay. First question. Can divine energies be a relation of some kind of relation? Second question, what exactly is the relational character of divine energies? In their existence prior to the creative act, are they part of God's essence or not? If they are, then why claim that they exist as a different class? Why not just say that they exist in the creative act? Now, if they are not, then what is their purpose? Surely God knows his glorification. He doesn't need the energies to know himself. Again, on this first move, where does God's absolute and personal trisipostatos, trisubstantial freedom fitting this relational character of energies prior to creation? Does God's essence and divine energies prior to creation necessitate the divine energies during and post-creation? Is there a necessary distinction between what God is and what that God does? Is there a distinction between God's usia and God's appearance in Transfiguration, the Mount Tabor? To elaborate more on this, did Peter see God or the divine energy of God as a relation in the trisipostaton of God in Mount Tabor? Did Peter see Jesus' body there or not? Was what he saw God or not? Are divine energies created or not? What is the difference between what Moses saw and what Peter saw of God? Now, the second position, self-manifestation of God, now, is this necessary or not? Is self-manifestation of God a necessary thing or not? Is his freedom a necessary characteristic of his self-manifestation? Is this self-manifestation different than his essence? What is the role of the person of Holy Spirit in the self-manifestation? Now, just one quick remark about this appropriation and Gregory Palamas' answer to these questions that are posed, that are put across to David. Okay, one core position of Gregory Palamas is that uncreated light is not inferior to understanding, nor symbolic, nor semantic of God. This is the position of Varlaam and his supporters. They thought this kind of stuff. Gregory Palamas didn't. Uncreated light for Gregory Palamas is deification. So it is part of the deification. It is deification. Now, we see many parallels with Aristotle here. Discussion of second entelech in God, in man, but not in God. God's entelech is totally different than man. In Plato's The Symposium, we see discussion of similar ideas, but note there that ecstasy is the union with the divine. Ecstasy for Gregory Palamas is not the union with God. It only leads to union. Now, essentialism is also rejected, and I finish with that. The disciples could see God, but could not partake of his essence. Knowledge of God is given via the divine energies, but the disciples could see, quotation marks, as far as they were able to bear it. And I close with the Feast of Transfiguration, Apolitikion, that we sing in the church. Thou wast transfigured upon the mountain, O Christ, O God, showing thy glory to thy disciples as far as they were able to bear it. And at the intercessions of the Mother of God, make thine everlasting light shine forth also upon us sinners. That was my deliberation.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Very nice.
Thank you.
Certainly regard as undoubtedly a saint and father of the Orthodox Church. And if you want evidence for that, look at Photius the Great, look at George Borowski, look at Seraphim Rose, none of whom are particularly known for their pro-Western sympathies. And I take the usage of Eros as opposed to Agios to denote an inferior class of saint as a wholly unwarranted innovation. Let's not forget that Palamas himself makes direct use of Augustine, including the idea of the Spirit as bond of love, which could be seen as dangerously filioquist, but I'm abusing my position.
A quick response to that. Agios Nicodemus Agioritis, Saint Nicodemus de Hagiore, and Saint Photios refer to Augustine as Eros, not Agios.
But they're not using it to denote a different class of saint, a special class of inferior Western saint.
But we should note that, okay, in opposition to what happens to Saint John Chrysostom. Okay. I mean, there is a distinction between St. John Chrysostom and Augustine. And the distinction is evident in the discussion of how they name them. And I think names are very important for Orthodox people. Okay, that's it.
Okay, well, let me ask a question.
Well, I'm not going to be referee in this one.
Likewise.
Yeah. It's a long-standing debate, in case you're not familiar with it, as to what exactly is the Orthodox view of Augustine. He is referred to as a saint or a blessed Augustine, however you want to put it, but usually in a context where people haven't read his writings because they were never translated until the 13th century. And even when they were translated, though, you can still argue both sides because Palamas apparently makes use of some ideas from the De Trinitate, you know, in the 150 chapters, some ideas about the psychological analogies for the Trinity he seemed to find very appropriate. That doesn't mean that Augustine is good altogether, but no saint is infallible, right? So I think the question of whether his teachings are good and the question of whether he's a saint are rather distinct. And of course, I'm focusing just on the teachings. I appreciate your enthusiasm for Palamas, and in a way, I'm just delighted because I've almost never met someone who's more of an enthusiast than I am, and so it's wonderful. I wouldn't go as far as to say that he was an expert on Aristotelian metaphysics, and I would say this about the later Greek fathers generally, Maximus and John Damascene and Palamas. All were living in a culture where, yes, those Aristotelian texts existed and could be read. It's not clear that they read all of them, because that was not their field. They were theologians and not philosophers by training.
Can I just say something about
that? Okay.
Gregory Palamas was a student at the University of Constantinople. He was put there by his father. He was a protege of the emperor. His teacher was Theodoros Matohides, a famous Aristotelian in Byzantine philosophy. He actually corrected Theodoros Matohides in front of the emperor. I mean, this is recorded by his biographers. So to correct the most eminent Aristotelian of your time for Byzantine world, for the Byzantine world, which is Theodoros Matohides, in front of the emperor, I mean, humiliating him in that way.
Yeah, well, Metachites praised Palamas for his knowledge of Aristotle,
exactly.
Didn't he?
Yeah.
So he took the criticism well.
Yes. But I mean, which means a famous Aristotelian scholar praising Palamas in front of the emperor while being corrected by Palamas. I mean, this is something to know.
Well and good. But even so, you know, he's not in the kind of academic setting that people like Aquinas are in, where you give long lectures and commentaries on the Aristotelian texts. Right? It's not. He doesn't have that kind of background or interest. So it's not to take anything away from him, just to say that wasn't his main concern. There were some substantive issues here about what does he mean? You know, it's a passage in Palamas, I believe, that he says the energies are relative. And Eric Pearl, I mentioned, quoting that. What exactly does Palamas mean? Well, that's why I think you have to understand the energies as a form of manifestation to another. That's what I take to be the relative character. And insofar as the energies are uncreated, then that could only be a revelation within the Trinity. I really don't see any other options for answering that question. But those are just my thoughts. Welcome others.
Can I just, there is a passage he discusses on the Holy Spirit's procession. Let me read it, where he's against the relational aspect of divine energies. I think he's not directly against your interpretation. I mean, there's something that you may want to have a look and use, okay? But you know, it is something that puts a doubt about this project. But it's not that it destroys the project. You know what I mean? So there is something that you can use. Let me read the passage and then translate it very quickly.
Very quickly.
Yes. Let me find it first. And then you will understand exactly what I mean.
Are there other people who've got questions, by the way?
Yeah. Let's start that, and then I'll find it and then say it.
Do we have anyone else waiting? Oh, yes. We'll take it.
Thank you.
The same light, you mean the same light that St. Peter saw in the Mount Tabor,
yeah, Mount Tabor.
And Moses?
Yeah,
what was that the same? Yes. Okay. You see, I mentioned that specific. I mentioned that specific distinction between what Moses saw and what Peter saw. Because it's a big debate about that between the West and the East, okay? And those who follow Augustine and those who go against Augustine. It's a big debate because it has to do with whether it was Logos incarnate that Moses saw, or it was only that Peter saw Logos incarnate. So there's a big debate between the Augustinians and the followers. Sorry?
Was it God?
Yes, it was. For me, it was. I don't know about David. But for Augustinians, it's not. It's not the same God, Logos, that Moses saw with what St. Peter saw. It's not the same Logos. And this is very important because it shows the big difference in the perspective with how in the East Orthodox we understand the incarnation and how the Augustinians understood it. The Augustinians, for instance, understand.
Even before we get to incarnation, let's leave that. I don't even want to go there, but I mean, just
uncreated light.
That's what
you
call it.
Yes.
It
is what you can see. Let me tell you. It is what you can see of God without getting killed or getting destroyed in the process.
Okay, I'm happy.
Because as I mentioned, you see, as I mentioned in the Apolitikion of the Transfiguration feast, right? It stresses there what the disciples saw is God, okay? That's what they saw. They didn't see the body of God. They saw God as a union of, as Jesus was, okay? And as they could bear, okay? Because seeing God may actually destroy you, you know? Yes.
I think we have to bring things to a close at that point. We've had a tremendously vigorous and, dare I say, energetic debate on Professor Bradshaw's book. And although there have been some quite definite disagreements, I think the vigor of the debate is a testament to the quality of the ideas that he's put forward in his work. And we'd like to thank you very much for coming with us and talking through it. I'd also like to thank our respondents, Professor Milbank, Dr. Erisman, Dr. Anasopoulos, for contributing to a tremendous event. We at the Institute for Orthodox Christian Studies are proud to have hosted this event, and we thank you for coming and look forward to seeing you again at future events. Thank you especially, above all, to Christoph Schneider for organising this wonderful event.